If you sat down today and wrote out your life story, how would you organize it? By the groups of friends around you at a given time? By the house you lived in? Or our guest this hour chose another method of organization, telling her story at least in part through the vehicles she drove. The book starts with a pickup truck with a stuck horn and moves through several other vehicles with issues. The people who ride in them have issues too. Melissa Stevenson is the author of the memoir Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back. Melissa Stevenson has had her writing published in The Washington Post and Rumpus, among others. She got her MFA in fiction from Texas State University, but now lives in Montana with her two kids. Driven is her first book. Melissa Stevenson, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Good to have you. So how did a person who studied fiction writing end up going nonfiction in her first book?
Good question. After earning my MFA in fiction, for various reasons, I kind of stepped away from writing for about 5 years or so, and I feel like when I was writing fiction, I kept writing fictionalized versions of the story that I was trying to tell, which was a real-life story. And so when I came back to writing, I started writing creative nonfiction, and that led eventually, after many years, to tackling this big story in my life that I think I kind of had to tell so that I could move on and write other things, and that became the memoir.
And so, I mean, was it an obvious thing once you just said, okay, that's it, I got to do a memoir, that it was going to be told through cars and trucks, or you know, did it take a little more thinking than that?
It was definitely the long route. It took me a long time to find the shaping device of the cars, and actually I couldn't face that I might be writing an entire book, or couldn't figure out how I might write an entire book until I found that kind of way to structure the story. So I'd written all these very short little pieces that were maybe just one or two pages, isolated memories. And once I had over 100 pages of those, a friend at the time said, I don't know, maybe you have a book. But whenever I tried to just write the story of my brother's death, which is kind of the central narrative in this book, it was too big and I didn't know where to start and I just felt overwhelmed and I'd give up. But one of those short little pieces I was writing was about the first car that my family bought new off the lot, a 1978 Velari. And as I was circling back to that piece and revising it and wondering what a little piece about a Velari could do, I kind of had a light bulb moment and made a list of all the cars that we grew up with and then realized the connection that I'd inherited my brother's 79 Ford F-150, which is the car that opens the book. I inherited that when he died. And once I kind of just jotted down the cars from our childhood and the cars that carried me through adulthood, I thought, oh, well, maybe this could work. And then I was able to write the longer narrative.
The Velari is a major character in the book, not quite rivaling your brother Matthew, your late brother Matthew. And
right.
It is a rough beginning to the book, your brother's truck honking intermittently. Mm-hmm. What was going on in life and in the truck?
At that point, I think it was just about a week after my brother's death, and that was 2 weeks after I'd moved from the north, Montana, all the way to Texas. And I'd never lived in the South before, and it was August, and it was extremely hot out, and I was really disoriented and grieving. And as I'm driving this truck, which is a conspicuous vehicle to begin with, the horn starts going off randomly. It didn't just get stuck on, but it's honking repeatedly. And, after dealing with that for a while, it must have been some type of electrical gremlin, but in the moment, I had to deal with the situation. I was extremely overwhelmed, and the honking would not stop. So I ended up having to drive that vehicle through rush hour traffic with the horn going off repeatedly, which was nerve-wracking.
Oh, at a minimum, yeah. It ends up in a bit more of a meltdown than we're letting on here, but people can read the book for that. So, but interesting to notice, though, as you work us further into the story of you and your family, that this is a bit of a multi-generational thing. It sounds like events with cars defined a number of things in your parents' generation.
Yeah, there's many stories. In fact, I heard many stories I didn't even know when I was writing the book, and I reached out to my family to clarify. You know, the book covers some of the cars that my parents had. They were teen parents, cars that they had before I was even born. So as I asked my family about these stories, other stories that I'd maybe heard snippets of or had never heard before came to me, and those are stories from, ranging from my grandmother driving into the front of a Kentucky Fried Chicken in her Buick. I'd heard a little bit about that story, but then I got more of that story. And with my parents and their families, there were many deaths or severe accidents that happened on either cars or motorcycles as they were growing up. And so as I brought in all of those stories, I realized that the interest in cars and the experiences with cars and the difficulties with cars went back further than just my memories.
So given that background, did you have any particular feeling about vehicles as a child? Were they just a conveyance, or were they something to fear or something to really celebrate?
I always felt at home in vehicles for whatever reason. I didn't have any fear around them. I'm sure growing up, you know, my parents weren't telling me some of the my parents really connecting the dots that we'd lost lots of people in our family in vehicle accidents, or they'd been injured in these accidents. So cars for me were always comforting. I liked to travel, and with the sort of economic class and social class I grew up with, travel usually meant just driving someplace that was either half an hour or at max an hour and a half away in Indiana. So those would be our sort of vacations, relatives' houses, and my memories of being in cars are really positively charged because of that.
Well, and as we grew up, certainly the car seemed a lot bigger when we were smaller, but we'll get into all sorts of aspects of life behind the wheel and through the windshield, which is the device for telling a life story that Melissa Stevenson has chosen. Her book is called Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back. You'll hear more from Melissa later on in the hour. I'll ask you to compare notes and talk about some of the key vehicles in your own life if you'd like to join us by phone or by email. We'll come back to the Jefferson Exchange with Melissa Stevenson and Driven in a minute 20. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Our guest is Melissa Stevenson, who got her MFA in fiction from Texas State University and discovered that as she wrote fictional stories, they were really fictionalized versions of a story she really needed to tell about her own life, namely the death of her late brother, Matthew. And that story and all the other people and players involved ended up getting shaped better by discussing it through vehicles. So now we have the book Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back, told through the backseat of a Volare and a lot of other cars. You can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we only briefly mentioned Indiana, but if you could just give us a broader setting of the scene for your childhood, Melissa, in the middle of the country, but certainly not in the middle of it all.
Yeah, Indiana seems to be a state that many people, if they've heard of it, it's because they drove through it. A lot of the interstates that would lead you north or south or east or west kind of intersect in Indiana. So it's very flat. Most people tend to just drive through. But I would say, in my family experience anyway, most people who are born there tend to stay there. I'm sure that's changing with my generation. But it's a very traditionally conservative state. Lots of farming and lots of people who have deep roots in the state and stay.
There's a reference on page 13 to what people called you as a child, and I just made me wonder if anybody named Melissa is ever not called Missy.
Yeah, I wonder too. I actually just came back from reading in my hometown, and it was interesting to have a whole audience full of people who thought of me as Missy. I don't hear that often these days since I don't live in Indiana, and it definitely brings me back to childhood.
The reference in that particular scene was to a tantrum. I mean, growing up, were you a bit of a handful?
Absolutely. Yes. I think there's a reference to myself as a petite tornado, which I'd forgotten about. But that's accurate. My tantrums were pretty epic, and that's one thing I grew up with, hearing the stories of my own tantrums long after I'd outgrown them and was a fairly quiet, grounded kid, but I certainly didn't start out that way.
And you describe your late brother Matthew as a difficult baby, but did he mellow out as he got out of babyhood?
He did. He was, and he wasn't difficult temperament-wise. He was very sick. He had some allergies, and I think more allergies than he even knew about before he died. But he had allergies that made him allergic to lots of things, a kind of traditionally colicky baby. And then one allergy to medicine made his baby teeth from the incisors in crumble. He called them the vampire teeth. And so all the pictures of him until his permanent teeth came in, you can just see the sort of vampire teeth, the incisors there, and no other teeth in the middle.
It's a great description. Even without pictures in the book, I feel like I've seen this image of Matthew as a child.
Right, great. That's good.
You describe this as pretty much the complete American nuclear family, mom, dad, boy, girl. How harmonious or not growing up?
You know, it's a hard thing to describe to people, especially later in the book when some of the dysfunction in the family becomes apparent, but that's very much how it went for me as well. I feel like I grew up in my younger years, say through middle school, as a member of the family that everyone wanted to be a part of. My parents were young, they were very hip, they were quite good looking and charismatic. And I feel like our house in those young days was a sort of hub where all of our friends would visit and sleep over, and you know, our childhood friends, and then my parents' friends would come over and play card games, and it was a good time. And my parents were doing very well for teenage parents. But as we grew older, things like mental illness and alcoholism, these things began to surface. And for me, writing the book was kind of reckoning with those two different versions of the story, the sort of charmed childhood I grew up with, and then the dysfunction that surfaced later.
You know, I'm struck too by your parents' reactions to how they were parented, which produced their parenting style. It happens with a lot of people, I know. But so what kinds of things did they choose not to do, or what was the general approach to parenting?
I'd say that their approach, and this is something one of my aunts told me later that she saw, and when she told me this, it rang true. They really wanted to be our friends. You know, they were late 60s teenagers in the late 60s. They were very hip, as hip as one can get in Indiana, with sort of the general vibe of love that was going on. And they were raised in more oppressive, authoritarian households. And so they really just tried to be our friends. And that sounds great, but that also means you've got two kids, my brother and I, running around with without a lot of boundaries and typical parental guidance, for better or for worse.
We're talking to Melissa Stevenson about her memoir, Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back, told through cars. And so let's come back to cars for just a moment. There's a lot of nostalgia here for older cars and trucks for readers, like, you know, your fond remembrances of VW Squareback. So why do you say that that car in particular set your expectations for cars unreasonably high?
When I think of the ideal car, I try to think of, you know, if I had one car that could do the most things for me, be the most versatile, what would that car be? And if you look back at the Squarebacks, they're kind of early station wagons. They've got lots of room for anything you might need to cart along. But as someone who loves to drive cross country and not spend money on hotels, you know, I also look at the square back and realize you can put the back seat down and have plenty of room to sleep back there as well. Plus, they're cute and attractive. So I'm a sucker for a square back.
I'm afraid we are in our family, too. I get the sense, though, by the time we read of the Mustang with the broken axle, that there was a series of battered hulks from the Stevenson family making their way down the street.
Yeah, I mean, I think as a family who, until Villari, couldn't afford a new car, and that was a big deal when we could. And I've run into this in my adult life as well. When you're always buying a cheap vehicle, what some might call a beater, right? Then you've always got some kind of vehicle problem that you have to deal with. So you do end up going through a quick series of various cars that kind of like houses. I love old houses, and then I'm always surprised when they need a ton of work and suck up all my money.
So this brings us to the Velare, which was the first brand new car in the family. And I've resisted the urge to get that Al Martino clip of him singing Velare. But, I mean, this was right. A big deal in your family, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's one of my earliest memories, and those memories, you know, I had to draw it out in narrative there, are often very sensory impressions. And so I remember sitting in that car, feeling the upholstery, and us driving off the lot with the car. And I remember my parents' demeanor, kind of dressing up, and my dad negotiating with a salesperson. And even at a very young age, I had a feeling that we needed to drive this car off the lot very quickly, because on some level, it was a stretch for us to afford a new car. So I had that feeling of trying to get away with the good thing.
That brings back memories, because the first time my mother bought a brand new car was probably around the same time, around 1976. And we actually went out and had ice cream, you know, to celebrate this, the new car in the family.
Yeah, that's great.
So, you know, I avoided bringing in Al Martino singing Volare, but music is a big part of the story. So tell us about your mom in particular and the use of the car radio.
Oh, yeah. We were driving away in the Volare. They'd have the radio on, and then later, once we'd had the car for a while, it had an 8-track player, which was fabulous. So they'd be able to put 8 tracks on, and we could control our music. But my mother loved to sing along while my dad drove. In a really good mood, my dad might sing as well. But I think that actual Volare memory is tangled up in my mind with Paradise by the Dashboard Light from Meat Loaf's album Bad Out of Hell. And I remember my mom, you know, belting out both parts of the duet, and my brother and I just sitting in the back seat, feeling like we were in the middle of a concert or a party and happy that she was happy.
Oh, that's fun. Ain't no doubt about it. We were doubly blessed. We were barely 17. We were barely dressed. Yeah, a whole generation of people know all those words.
Yes. Every word.
Well, when I think about that, it doesn't really surprise me to learn that you became a bit of a performer yourself. And once you grew out of your tantrums, where did your interest lie in your early adolescence?
You know, I did lots of different performing arts before I ended up being someone who's kind of behind the curtain as a writer. And I credit my mother there. She was a very attractive girl growing up, and her own mother had pushed her to become a model. But then she ended up having a kid and getting married at 17. And so I think from the time I was 4, she had me in ballet and figure skating and doing the young community theater musicals and plays. And so I was a performer at that age, and I think I channeled a lot of the energy and drive behind my tantrums into these performances. And I would even do my own solo, you know, in my bedroom, extensive lip syncing performances, which are cringeworthy to think of now, but I remember them being great fun back then.
And they're great fun to read about, too. The book is called Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back. Melissa Stevenson is the author and our guest on The Exchange. It deals with the early death of her brother Matthew and a lot of other dysfunctions that cropped up in the family as the years went on, framed by the vehicles that she often was driving at the time, or at least riding in. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So you mentioned that you had calmed down. You've been much more thoughtful child as you got into your adolescence. Now, what about Matthew? He changed in adolescence too. And what were some of the manifestations of his change?
Yeah, he kind of went from being the colicky baby to then a really grounded, tender-hearted younger kid. But as he hit adolescence, he got pretty wild. And by wild, I mean very independent. He was very charismatic, so he was always sort of the center of a larger group of kids, and let's see, it was the 80s, so they were always off skateboarding, and ours was definitely a free-range childhood, which was more typical back then. And so on a summer morning, he would leave the house on his skateboard and maybe blow through with his friends a few times for snacks or whatever, but in general, he was out and about all day, every day, running around with his friends.
And then, of course, at one point, he ran away. And I love the story of how your aunt found Matthew. What did she have to do to figure out where he was?
Yeah, I'm still not sure how she figured that out. I think at the time he had run away, it was after he'd, you know, had his first girlfriend and was dating another girl after that, I believe. And he took off for 3 days. And somehow we knew through the girlfriend that perhaps he'd gone to Bloomington, Indiana, which is a town not far from the town we grew up in. And this aunt had married into the family, and she was kind of our youngest, hippest aunt. And so she put on a young hip sort of outfit for the time, I think a mini skirt and some Reebok high tops. And she went over to Bloomington and thought, where's the kind of place my brother would hang out? She went to an arcade, and she had a picture of her little four-year-old daughter with my brother. And the first kid she walked up to, she showed the picture and said, you know, do you know this kid? And that kid ended up leading her to my brother. She bought him some gas station food or some fast food, and he ended up leading her to my brother, who was on a mattress in the basement of sort of a house where a bunch of kids were squatting, and my aunt was able to bring him home.
And how are your parents responding? What kinds of things were they doing to and for Matthew to try to accommodate him or figure out what he was going on with or to figure out how to help him?
I think they were already in a little bit of denial, just thinking, oh, this is normal. Teenage kids have big feelings and difficulties. And while that's true, when your kid runs away, that's kind of a big deal. My mother would get upset with him, and he and my mother tended to argue, and my dad would tend to be quiet and supportive. And already I was seeing that pattern that I didn't understand then, to normalize the sort of increasingly problematic behavior of my brother. So an event would happen, it would be a big ordeal for a day, and then everyone just kind of wanted things to go back like normal.
And so even though Matthew was the one who ran away at that point, I mean, the one to leave on a regular basis was you. You went to boarding school in Michigan. What prompted that?
I had been born with this sense that I was meant to live elsewhere. And it's one of those things that I didn't know was unusual or peculiar until I got old enough to realize that the people around me didn't feel the same way. So I always liked to travel, and I always daydreamed about a bigger life across Indiana state lines. And I started receiving information from various boarding schools, even though boarding school was not something that was in my family history or culture at all. It was extremely far from the way we lived. But I'd write to places advertised in the back of magazines, like 17 Magazine, and I'd get information about their boarding schools. And eventually I found out about a fine arts school, think of a FAME type school in the woods of northern Michigan. It's called Interlochen. And I applied to that in eighth grade without telling my parents. They quickly found out through a teacher of mine, and they took me up to audition to humor me, thinking, of course, I wouldn't be able to go. But then I had the good fortune of being admitted and offered a significant scholarship. And so at 14, I left home to go to boarding school.
And you thought you'd bombed the audition?
Yes. I still think I bombed the audition. Oh, that was terrible. I auditioned for theater, and, you know, I was 14 years old and came in with my monologue, and I just, one reason I ultimately left theater is that I am quite a bit of an introvert, and I do suffer, even during readings for this book tour. I have to deal with stage fright. I'm much older now, and I've taught for many years, so I handle it better. But in this audition, when I was 14 years old at Interlochen, I went tone deaf. I almost feel like I half left my body just trying to get through this audition. And I was very surprised to find out that they admitted me a month later.
Wow. Congratulations on
getting into
Interlochen. So here you are then leaving basically a nuclear family of three behind. I mean, how did Matthew handle your absence, or did he even really notice you were gone?
We lived kind of parallel but separate lives by then. Let's see. When I was in eighth grade, he was in 11th. So when I left school or left for Interlochen and started as a freshman in high school, he was in his senior year in high school. And by then, my parents kind of, if he wasn't getting in trouble, they kind of just let him be. And then I was off at Interlochen doing my own thing. But the funny thing is, we started to actually grow closer during those years, because when I would come home on the holidays, it was a short visit. And so we'd make a point to at least talk a little bit and try to connect. And I feel like that's when we started to develop our own relationship, when we graduated from being siblings who would torment each other, or he would torment me, is the way I felt. And we, after that, morphed into having our own sort of adult relationship.
But maybe the biggest revelation of the book is that he ended up with the Volare. They gave it to him as a graduation present?
Yeah, he was always bitter because he thought I got better cars than he did. But they gave him the Volare, and that's the car he drove. He wasn't very comfortable with driving at all. But he did go to a college program in Vincennes, Indiana, which was about 2 hours away, and they gave him the Volare. And that was the car that he drove when he did choose to drive for a few years.
All right. We have more questions about Matthew's choices about life after high school and the things that led to his eventual death, which is one of the major topics in the book Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back, the memoir by Melissa Stevenson, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join the conversation, and we'll urge you in a couple minutes ahead to talk about the cars of your own life as well. 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Back on the Jefferson Exchange with Driven, Melissa Stevenson, and you in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest is Melissa Stevenson. She's had her writing published in the Washington Post and Rumpus, among others. Got her MFA in fiction from Texas State University. And realized the more she wrote fictional pieces, they were really about things that had happened in her own life. So she finally decided to focus her attention fully on that and wrote a memoir called Driven, a story essentially told through the cars of her life as a child and as an adult. The book is called, the subtitled, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back, the major heartbreak being the loss early in life of her brother Matthew. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Join it and talk about the cars that have shaped your life, the ones that you have some fond memories of or wish you had never set foot in, perhaps. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. So we were just talking about how you and Matthew were getting along when you were getting older and had begun to communicate a little better, send letters to each other when you were off at boarding school. I don't want to get too graphic. There's a car you were driving at this time called the Turd, which sort of parallels some of the features of your brother's communications. Well, let's not go too far into that. But somebody does ask you, Melissa, at this point in your life, if you and your brother are close, and it produces this kind of stop the train moment for you. Why was that such a hard question to answer?
In that moment, there's something about being asked that question directly. I was at boarding school, and I'd developed the habit of telling lots of stories about my kind of wild, precocious, unusual brother. Going to boarding school, I was exposed to an entirely different culture, and I became aware that some things about growing up in Indiana and many things about my brother were unusual. So I loved to tell these stories, and there was something in that moment when my friend asked me that question where I kind of stopped and realized that while I put my brother on a pedestal and he was sort of a star in my sky and had a lot of qualities that I wished I'd had myself, I certainly didn't think he looked at me the same way. And so as the older writer looking back on this moment, I'm aware of certain things like, you know, imitation is a way to form closeness where it might not actually exist. And so looking back on that, I'm like, I bet that's why that moment kind of gave me pause. I'm not sure that it's true that I could have told someone and believed it at that age that we were actually close. I was trying to mend that gap or that distance.
Mm-hmm. Did the relationship, in hindsight, does it feel like it was very asymmetrical? I mean, even then, did it feel that way?
In my teen years, it definitely felt that way. As we grew into young adults, you know, he was just alive through the first half of my 20s. And I think those are the years where, in those split seconds that I could kind of make eye contact with him, I realized the relationship was very important to both of us.
But it wasn't easy to make that eye contact, though, you're saying.
It wasn't. We had a kind of mutual shyness, and, you know, true to the book and true to my family, we could talk about music, we could talk about cars, we could talk about our dogs, but actually saying things like, hey, I love you, or it looks like you're having a hard time, those bigger things were never things that we felt very comfortable talking about.
Did you get a sense back then, or at least entertain the hope that his path would straighten out and get easier?
I think we all just banked on that. That's the thing that made us able to sleep at night when we could, which is most of the time, until he'd have an episode or an incident. And for me, it's been a great lesson in trusting my gut, because my gut always said with him that the other shoe was going to drop and it wasn't going to be good. But I think we all kind of helped tell each other the pretty story that he's just a charismatic but kind of troubled guy trying to find his way. And if we just leave him alone and let him do his thing, he'll find his way through.
So he certainly had his own demons to deal with, as does anybody in life. But then here you were, not even able to be close to the family in any sort of immediate kind of support. I mean, what were you feeling about the family situation while you're many miles away in northern Michigan, far from the family home in Indiana? Were you feeling like, gee, I wish I could be there sometimes? Or were you just feeling relieved to be away from it, or some mixture of things?
I think in my first couple years when I was studying theater before I found writing, and I was younger, you know, 15, 16, when I would have a hard time, I'd miss the comfort of home. Not necessarily being in Indiana, but just being able to talk with my parents and kind of get away from it all. At boarding school, if you have problems, especially social problems, you're living with those people, so it's hard to get relief. So in my first couple years, I had some homesickness. But in my last couple years, once I found writing and kind of got more comfortable with myself, I felt a little guilty at how much I didn't miss home.
Hmm. All right. So you were able to define that as like, oh, this is something I'm feeling.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we haven't talked about your parents that much yet, about and how they were dealing with you being away. It sounds like your mother in particular was struggling a bit.
Yeah, she used to say, it's one of the lines that she would repeat quite often, that the day I left for Interlaken was the day she started taking Prozac. And then, you know, she would laugh. We have a great sense of humor in my family, but it was one of those lines that definitely was the awkward laugh for me. It didn't make me feel great. Looking back now, it's quite remarkable that she ended up with an empty nest at, I think, age 38. My brother was pretty much out of the house. I was at Interlaken. So I think for her, it wasn't just facing depression and empty nest and taking Prozac. She also started to kind of have her party days that she never had as a teenager, because I remember coming home to visit and there would be lots of wine drinking with all of her friends. And I think that's how she coped. And then our dad just really kept working. He's always been a bit of a workaholic, and he'd join in on the social scene and the party and a little bit, but he kind of just kept working.
So it seems like we've been talking only about Matthew's dysfunction. I don't want that to be the only thing discussed here. He did, it sounds like, have a bit of an artist's temperament or artist sensibility.
Yeah, he was really artistic. I still have many of his really intricate, amazing drawings that my mom was able to use to get him admitted to Heron Art School in Indianapolis, which is a great program. For various reasons, he chose not to go. And he also loved music, just the way he would talk about music and the art of the mixtape, even. He had impeccable taste, and I think for him, one of the most positive roles he played in life is if he latched onto a band or someone's writing. He was a big reader, too. He was quite the muse and a real strong support system, and there's many people I've encountered who maybe played in bands, and they'd say, Matt was up front at every one of our shows, and that's something he gave to me with my writing, too. I really feel like he was my biggest fan and would always say, what are you writing next? I'm waiting for it, and that was fantastic.
Oh, that's a great support system, sure. So the part one of the book ends with maybe 8 sentences about Joshua. That's a huge progression in 8 sentences. Could you flesh out the Joshua story just a bit more?
Yeah, I think that the part one ends with, it's an ambitious section of the book because it attempts to cover an entire childhood and then transition into the next part of the book, which begins with me in the year 2000 as a newlywed moving with my husband down to Texas. And so just in those last few sentences, I kind of wrap up where I was with the cars. I just got my first Volkswagen van, and I quickly let the reader know then I, you know, got a house and a dog and a boyfriend who became my husband.
And that's the 8 sentences, basically, yeah. Not with him anymore, we gather.
No, we have 2 kiddos together, and he was actually a huge support with reading and helping me know how to, with reading driven and helping me know how to get a book out there in the world. He's and so we're still in regular contact. We're still friends and co-parents, but no longer married.
We'll hold part 2 of the book in reserve for people who want to read it. Did you have to think very hard about the vehicles and the parts of your life they represent? I mean, were they fairly close to the surface and didn't require too much dredging?
You know, I, as a writer, I think my first instinct is to take certain things that I might not know how they're related. In this case, you know, the car I owned and then what was going on in my life at the same time. And part of the fun for me is to go ahead and write those stories linked to those cars in this case without really knowing exactly what the connection is. Similarly, when I write an essay or something, I might know the story I want to tell, a few interesting details that need to be in that story. But it's often not until I've drafted the whole thing, and sometimes not until second or third draft, that all the deeper connections kind of rise to the surface. So some of the connections between cars and life were pretty apparent to me from the beginning, but a lot of the deeper, more interesting connections took a while to surface, but that's part of the fun of writing for me.
And at this point in your life, with a career going well and 2 kids and everything, do you think about a car as much more than transportation, or do you still call your cars she and give them names and things like that?
Oh, yeah, my kids name the cars now, and I wish I could be more practical with cars. We now have 2 Volkswagen camper vans, and we live in Montana, and they're both 2-wheel drive, one's rear-wheel drive,
oh,
so
boy.
I clearly still have a car problem. But my kids have named the vans, and I argue with my son over whether one of them is a he or a she, so the habit continues.
How much do you talk to the kids about Uncle Matt? It sounds like they never had a chance to meet him.
They didn't. My son was born 6 years after he died, and then my daughter 9 years after. They went on much of my book tour with me over the past 3 weeks. They went, they tagged along for 2 weeks of that. And so because of the book, I actually had to tell them details that they didn't know. And you know, safe versions of that story with plenty of time to process and time for questions. But they've tagged along for reading, so they've heard these stories, and my son would even ask a few questions after readings. And, of course, I was picking passages that I thought would feel safe and okay, and even there's humor in the book, even have a little levity for them. But all they really knew beforehand was that I had a sibling who died, and then later they knew some more of the details about how he died. But until the past few months, I didn't use the word suicide. And so that's something I had to talk about with them.
Just explaining the concept and why people do it, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And how sometimes that can be linked to family history of other issues, whether it's mental illness, or addiction, and, you know, just having that larger conversation about family history and how people, you get kind of backed into a corner in life and make choices that they might not make if they had some more support and understanding.
When you look at the way society responds now, I mean, I know we seem to have at least quarterly discussions of suicide here with a constant reminder from people who know mental illness, don't be afraid to talk about it. Do you wish things like that had been around when Matt was going through some of his stuff?
I sure do. And part of that, I mean, that's one of the biggest motivators for me to write this story. I kept thinking, who would ever read this story? It's going to be too heavy. It's going to be too hard. And, you know, by the time I was through many drafts, I could see the humor and the lightness, and I could feel it start to come alive and be something that a reader could appreciate. But I really felt overwhelmed by that silence around grief. I'd never been through grief before. And when I went through grief, I had just moved to a new place. I had no support network. I was 25. I was making these new friends who were writers. And I felt like to grieve well meant not talking about it, meant actually making yourself feel fine, or at least pretending that you felt fine. And looking back at 25-year-old me, not wanting to talk about suicide, not feeling that I could talk about it without making other people feel bad, I feel great compassion, because that's a huge load to carry by yourself.
Absolutely. And I'll tell you, anybody who reads the account of you getting out of the truck that is still honking away and realizing all the things you're dealing with there has a lot of compassion for you in that moment. There's a lot of really great stuff in the book. It's called Driven, A White-Knuckled Ride to Heartbreak and Back. It is the work of Melissa Stevenson. And no, it's not just about cars. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed it.
It's a pleasure.